Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, December 19th through Saturday, the 21st, feature guest conductor and pianist Lahav Shani. The program includes the overture to Egmont, incidental music by Beethoven, Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2, and after intermission, Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 1. And here are notes by guest annotator Richard Rota on the Shostakovich Piano Concerto No. 2, a work lasting about 17 minutes. The life and music of Dmitri Shostakovich abound in dichotomies. In 1925, he was accompanying silent films on a battered piano in a frigid Leningrad cinema. A year later, after the premiere of his first symphony, he was hailed at the age of 20 as the leader of the first generation of post-revolution Soviet composers. During Hitler's siege of Leningrad, he worked on the giant Seventh Symphony between tours of duty as a fireman. He was denounced in 1948 as a musical scoundrel. In 1954, he was honored as People's Artist of the USSR. And 2 years later, given the Lenin Prize. He was the chief adornment and most visible representative of Soviet culture for almost four decades, though he did not join the Communist Party until 1962. His music, as well, is filled with stark contrasts. Beginning with the Symphony No. 1, many of his individual works juxtaposed satire and pathos, grandeur and tragedy. The avant-garde style of his first mature decade, grotesque humor, biting dissonance, steely expressivity, was followed, beginning with the Fifth Symphony, by music of conservatism and universal appeal. Symphonies numbers 11 and 12, extolling Lenin and the revolution, were succeeded by a musical condemnation of Soviet anti-Semitism in the 13th Symphony. While maintaining a recognizable personality throughout his oeuvre, Shostakovich displayed a wider range of musical attitudes than perhaps any composer except Gustav Mahler, by whom he was indelibly influenced. The dichotomy dividing Shostakovich's works between those primarily for public display and those that were more introspective and reflective of his deepest thoughts veered in his later years toward the latter. The wondrous series of string quartets and the last three symphonies are the principal evidence. Standing beside these inward-looking pieces, however, is a large amount of immediately appealing music embodying one of his most important tenets. I consider that every artist who isolates himself from the world is doomed. I find it incredible that an artist should wish to shut himself away from the people. One of the best crafted among this group of film scores, tone poems, jingoistic anthems, and occasional instrumental works is a piano concerto that Shostakovich wrote in 1956-57 for his son, Maxim, who was just finishing his studies at the Moscow Conservatory. The Piano Concerto No. 2 follows the classical model in its three-movement, fast-slow-fast structure, but brings to the old formal type a typically Shostakovian wit and personality that makes it very much a work of the mid-20th century. The outer movements, both marked allegro, are propelled by an almost demonic energy grown from a hybrid of march and gallop. They call for an invigorating display of virtuosity, nimble, powerful, percussive by turns, that gives soloists ample opportunity to display their technique. In contrast, the slow middle movement for piano and strings only, with the exception of a single entry by the solo horn, is of a lyricism and tenderness reminiscent of Chopin, filtered perhaps in its harmonic suavities through Poulenc. Program notes by guest annotator Richard Rota on the Shostakovich Piano Concerto No. 2. And now on to Johannes Brahms' Symphony No. 1, a work lasting about 52 minutes. Beethoven died 6 years before Brahms was born, but his presence was felt by almost every composer who came after him. Even Brahms, a master of piano music and songs from an early age, put off writing symphonies and string quartets, two Beethoven forms par excellence, offering only the pathetic but honest excuse You can't have any idea what it's like always to hear such a giant marching behind you. Eventually, Brahms turned and faced the giant, but it took him nearly 20 years to do so, and only the magnificence of his own First Symphony gave him the courage to leave the ghost of Beethoven behind him for good. Few great works of music have taken so long to get from sketch to finished product. Obviously, Brahms had his reasons for sitting on his First Symphony, but eventually his friends and colleagues began to wonder if he, like Schubert before him, might leave an unfinished symphony in the attic. In fact, in 1870, Brahms said he would never complete the piece. His publisher, Fritz Schimrock, finally wrote, "Aren't you doing anything more? Am I not to have a symphony from you in 73 either?" But there was no symphony in 1873, just as there had been no symphony any year since 1854, when Brahms first set out to write one. That earliest effort in the key of D minor, the key of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, incidentally, neatly sidestepped the issue to become Brahms's first piano concerto, even though the idea of symphony is written all over it. Brahms also avoided the challenge with the two serenades that gave him needed and valuable experience writing for the orchestra without directly taking on Beethoven. There was a further testing of the waters in the substantial orchestral accompaniment to A German Requiem and other important choral works, and finally, a dress rehearsal of sorts, the grand Variations on a Theme of Haydn from 1873, though this too, for all its mastery of instrumentation and intellectual rigor, was not a symphony. But Brahms did have a symphony in the works. As early as 1862, he sent a completed first movement to Clara Schumann. "Imagine my surprise," she wrote to Josef Joachim, who would one day play the violin concerto Brahms wrote for him in a single summer. Clara's surprise eventually turned to dismay when Brahms continued to drag things out, sending her the horn call from the finale as a birthday card some 6 years later, and finally sitting her down to listen as he played the whole symphony at the piano another 8 years after that. Although Brahms certainly took his time, he proved to an impatient musical public that there was still music being written that was worth the wait. Unlike his contemporary, Anton Bruckner, who made a career out of having second thoughts, Brahms was the best judge of his own work. When a piece didn't please him, he put it aside, or reworked it, or in the case of his Fifth Symphony, he destroyed it. But he wouldn't release it. When Brahms sent his completed first movement to Clara Schumann in 1862, it didn't begin with the fierce and arresting introduction we know, but took off like a rocket from the headlong Allegro. Clara confessed to Joachim that the beginning seemed bold and rather harsh, but I have become used to it. Brahms, however, evidently didn't, because when he played the entire symphony for Clara more than a dozen years later, it began with the powerful, measured drumbeat and chromatic unfolding that now leads straight into the Allegro. Even though it was written after the fact, or perhaps because of that, Brahms's introduction serves as a preview of what follows, the opening violin line rising by half steps, for example, and the falling thirds in the winds will both be whipped into meaningful shape elsewhere. The Allegro is conceived on the largest scale. The final turn into the recapitulation in particular is stretched to incredible lengths, and then, with the destination clearly in sight, resolution is further delayed by a daring descent into a remote key. For a moment it appears that Brahms has thrown caution to the wind, but this sudden whim, too, is part of his plan, all calculated with the skill of a master craftsman. From the beginning, Hermann Levy, a perceptive German conductor, thought the two inner movements more suited to a serenade or a suite. But brevity and conciseness aren't at odds with the symphonic scale, although the grandeur of Brahms's first movement might lead one to expect something equally imposing to follow. Instead, Brahms's slow movement in the surprising key of E major is intimate and modest, with lovely woodwind solos and a magnificent one for the violin at the end. The third movement is no scherzo, but an intermezzo, as warm and ingratiating as Brahms's piano pieces, which actually bear the name. With the finale, we come again to Beethoven, partly because any symphony that begins in C minor and then forges triumphantly into C major at the end must face comparison with Beethoven's Fifth, and partly because Brahms's big allegro melody suggests nothing more than the great song of Beethoven's Ode to Joy. When the likeness was pointed out, Brahms simply said, "Any ass can see that." More to the point, Donald Tovey noted that Brahms's theme is regularly compared with Beethoven's only because it is the solitary one among hundreds of the same type that is great enough to suggest the resemblance. There are other echoes of Beethoven, too. Certainly the finale's extensive introduction, clouded with mystery and flaring up with occasional turbulence, takes a cue from Beethoven's Ninth. But then, so do countless works written in the 19th century that don't profit from the comparison. There's also much that is pure Brahms, like the unforgettable horn call that parts the clouds and admits the bright sunlight of the C major allegro theme, or the brilliant and hair-raising coda, which nearly beats Beethoven at his own game. The ending, in fact, is as exalted and triumphant as any in music, and it's clear that the triumph is Brahms's alone. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Johannes Brahms, Symphony No. 1. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.